know what day it is. It's the 30th of January, 31st of January. Oh, wow. It's just gotten ahead of me. We're going to go a little bit out of order today, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2071.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2071 increases the service charge from $1 to $2.50 per transaction that agents of the State Marine Board may impose for issuing a temporary permit to operate a boat. We have received a no revenue impact. We're still waiting for the fiscal. This particular measure does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, although I did want to note for the members that the department indicates to me that the department doesn't receive any revenues or has any fiscal impact from this measure, so you may consider rescinding that subsequent referral. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Paul Don Hefner and Paul Meyer, if you want to come up together, that would be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. This is an agency bill to adjust the service fee that our boat registration agents charge to issue temporary permits and other transactions. We've got about 125 bonded agents around the state that perform this service. The agents are required to maintain a $1,000 bond, which costs them approximately $100 annually. And in return, they maintain an account for state funds, transfer legal documents, including titles, and issue temporary permits. Some of the transactions can be time-consuming, especially when boat owners come in lacking the necessary paperwork. These fees haven't been adjusted since 1975, when the fee was set at its present $1 per transaction level. Factoring in inflation, rising minimum wages, and the overall cost of doing business, if we applied an inflation calculator to that dollar, it would be $3.75 today. The fee requested is $2.50. Boat owners can avoid these fees by mailing in their transactions or renewing online, and so it's not something that boat owners have to pay. It's merely a convenience for them when they use the services of an agent. Many people wait till the day before they're going on vacation and then rush into an agent, and so they pay the fee. Most of these agents are small businesses, and we think that after 30 years, the current fee level needs to be adjusted, that this is reasonable and justified. As your staff noted, there is no revenue impact to the state. None of this money comes to our agency. It's all a service fee that the agent keeps. There is no revenue impact to the state. There's no expenditure impact to the state. And therefore, we would respectfully request that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be rescinded. I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gunner.
Paul, when we visited in my office and we talked about, okay, I go into a boat dealership and I buy a new boat. What would be the mechanism then for me to do that online with a new purchase?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilman, with a new boat, generally the agent would be the one that processes that fee. However, you would have the option of getting a manufacturer's statement of origin and a bill of sale and mailing those to Salem for your title if you weren't going to be using the boat right away. But the benefit of using an agent for that is you'd have a temporary permit and be able to go right then and there. So for those people that are first time in a first-time transaction, the fee may be unavoidable. But I think, as you may hear from the representative from Stevens Marine here, Paul, that many of the transactions that they process are, in fact, simple renewals that boaters could avoid by either mailing in or doing it online.
Thank you. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Paul, was there any discussion as to how to keep this fee from going this far in arrears after 30 years again, or any method of automatic escalators, perhaps every 5 years, a CPI of some sort, rounded to the next 25 cents or 50 cents?
Madam Chair, Representative Butler, no, we didn't look at that kind of a mechanism, but if that's something the committee would like us to explore, we certainly could, perhaps through a rulemaking procedure.
Madam Chair, I'm anxious about these kinds of fees that they really don't become critical to anybody in state government until they are absolutely paralyzing to the local industry and the local folks. I know that if I was charging 30-year-old costs at my filling station or at my accounting office, that one or the other would go broke in a hurry, if not both. So I'm anxious that perhaps through, as Paul indicates, they do have a method of doing this through the rulemaking process, that these are the kinds of fees. They don't affect the state. They affect the retailer. And for whatever reason those costs continue to escalate, they need to have some sort of a automatic escalator, perhaps every 3 to 5 years, so we stay out of the middle of it, and that's a local fee that's generated for their benefit locally. I'd also agree with Paul that the costs, the inflation costs, the minimum wage inflation costs, that alone from 30 years ago to today is triple in the state of Oregon, and we need to just be very cognizant of the kinds of things that we're shoving down on local retailers, that they need to be able to have the tools in their toolkit to be responsive to account for those costs and to recover them in their businesses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, I'll go ahead and go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, and members of the House Transportation Committee. I'm Paul Mayer. I'm from Stevens Marine, and I also am the president of the Portland Marine Dealers Association, so I'm here representing that body. We work closely with the Marine Board in a, you know, if not day-to-day, weekly basis to try to make sure that transactions for customers that can appear to them to be complicated get processed in an easy way, providing an easy path to the waterways and a legal document so that they don't get ticketed. And we feel like that's a real good thing that we offer. I was talking to our title clerk on the way over here and, you know, asked her about the challenges that she sees and to get outlined to me. And you know, you see death certificates where a widow comes in and she doesn't want to go online and, you know, she wants help and we have a person there that's, you know, not a phone call, not a telephone prompt, but somebody to actually help her and make copies and do all that stuff. And then we have, you know, the sun pops out and we have lines of people where there's, you know, 10 people in there that haven't done what they should have done to take the mailing that's sent by the Marine Board and just put a stamp on the check and send it in to make it easy. And you know, they're there and they're hot and they want to get going and impatient. And I have to have a person on staff all the time, really every hour that we're open, to make sure that we aren't offending the public by not having that service available because they just figure it just should be. I agree, it should be. However, the cost is growing for doing that, and we haven't had any relief from that. I'm urging you to consider the fee of $2.50 as not unfair, and certainly they have other options with the internet registration that's available, with the mailings that they get in the mail, and then for our customers buying new boats, with regards to your question, they can be provided a manufacturer's statement of origin. They can take that to the Marine Board. They could get a same-day permit by driving here, but certainly we provide that service too and are glad to do it. I personally will go over there and write a Marine Board temporary for a customer, take my time to do it, and I'm always glad to do it because, you know, we're trying to encourage boating and boating revenues. If people have a hard time, you know, registering their boats, they're going to quit using them. If they quit using them, then agencies like his will have less revenues to you know, do the work that you all do down here. So I'm just urging that you can give us some reasonable increase of that fee, and I don't think it's an unreasonable amount to ask for, you know, a little bit of increase.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Representative Butler.
Madam Chair, this is excellent testimony, and I appreciate both of these folks testifying on behalf of this to be responsive to the needs of voters and to the industry. And I would go back to Mr. Don Hefner about his idea of perhaps putting something in the administrative rules about taking a look at this on a more frequent basis and perhaps even automatically. If, in fact, the CPI on a $1 fee from 1975 is $3.75, I'm wondering why they don't consider the possibility over the next 3 years to take this from $2.50 right up to the $3.75 itself, and then begin to escalate that fee so that these folks can have something reasonable to help you and help voters get back out on the waters as quick as they can. And then maybe that will encourage those few who say, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to pay $3.75 in 2009. You say, fine, go on the Internet and take care of it there and go on and enjoy your voting. So I would just encourage perhaps even amendment to the current proposed legislation that they take it up to $3.75 within the next 3 years and that they continue to escalate it for CPI from that point forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Butler. That's what I was curious about was I think it's probably a good idea. I was curious about your comfort level and where you think they should go, but that's a pretty clear direction. Is there any other comments on that?
Yeah, just a question, gentlemen. How's your comfort level with that? Are you know, concerned about customers' negative reaction, anything like that?
Not really concerned about that as much as I would be concerned about a request to change something that we are working on now that would possibly stall it and make it so it just couldn't happen because there were more hurdles to overcome. And excuse me, I'm not familiar with all of the processes down here, but I testified, I've testified before about this, and then nothing happened. And I know that we've been working for as much as 5 or 6 years to try to get some relief from this, and it hasn't gone very well for us. So I appreciate that you're all supportive of it. However, I wouldn't want to do something that would throw another level of complication into it so that we couldn't get at least this done. Maybe you can tell me about how that works.
Thank you.
If I may say,
yes, you may.
If I may, Paul, that was then. This is now. We've got this lady right here who is going to be responsive to these kinds of things, and you've got the director of the Marine Board here with us. He can help us, and I think as a member of the committee, we'll do all that we can to make sure that whatever amendments need to be made to make this workable now at the $2.50 so that you folks can see the $3.75, which is your true cost in it from the CPI. And then we'll pledge as a committee that we'll work with you to get this bill passed through the committee and out to the, and rescind the subsequent referral so that it goes right to a vote on the floor. And again, this appears to be a very reasonable. Madam Chair, I look around what we've got as partners for the state of Oregon and these kinds of activities, whether they're selling or assisting us with boat licenses or selling tobacco for us or other kinds of things, lottery tickets. And I look at that and I say, these folks are the ones that are making the state general fund whole and successful. These are the folks that are helping the Marine Board accomplish its purpose. So we just—I think we could expedite it if Paul will work with us too and speed it along so that the folks that are assisting us know that they've got $2.50 in statute now, but that we give them the authority, Marine Board the authority, to take it to the $3.75 within 3 years, and that from that point forward it'll continue to be CPI indexed. Thank you again.
Thank you. I certainly echo those sentiments. I think that it looks like you have a very willing group of people here that will do that for you, and we'll meet right away and okay. Get an amendment going.
I'll work with your staff on that amendment.
Thank you.
Thank you all for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that needs to testify on House Bill 2071? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2071. and open the public hearing on House Bill 2072.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. HB 2072 repeals the sunset on changes regarding reciprocity for ocean charter vessels and outfitting and guiding licenses of other states. You do have a copy at your seat at the dais, the Dash 1 amendments. Those amendments allow the State Marine Board to adopt rules to waive the annual fees for a person who possesses a current Oregon outfitter and guide registration and operates in the waters of the Columbia River downstream from the Lewis and Clark Bridge. The amendment also adds an emergency clause that would be effective upon passage. We have received no revenue impact statement. We're waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to call all of the people that signed up together, and that's Paul Don Hefner, Jack Glass, and Paul Rainey. So go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, Paul Don Hefner, Director of the Marine Board. This, again, is an agency bill that deals with reciprocity, particularly on the Columbia River. Essentially, the bill removes a sunset provision that was included in 2005 legislation, that was House Bill 2084, that gave us more flexibility to work with the state of Washington for reciprocity on the Columbia River. If the sunset is not repealed this session on January 1 of next year, the law would revert back to language which was adopted in 1995, which was a sticking point for getting to reciprocity. So we feel that removal of the sunset is essential if we're to move forward. We have negotiated with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife to arrive at a solution. While that's been slow and frustrating, on January 23rd of this year, they did adopt a rule granting reciprocity on the lower river up to the bridge at Longview Rainier. However, it only allows for charter-to-charter reciprocity, not charter-to-guide reciprocity. Because of some peculiarities in their statutes, they don't feel that they can extend it to guides, and so our way around that sticking point is to issue a charter boat endorsement to the guides, the Oregon guides that fish on the lower river. However, we don't want to charge our guides that are already registered an additional fee. And so the amendment that we had prepared for this would allow us to waive the fee for Oregon registered guides so that we can give them that charter boat endorsement and they'll have reciprocity on the lower river. Washington has also agreed to continue negotiations and work on reciprocity above the Longview Bridge. And so I anticipate we'll continue to make progress towards that. But if we don't eliminate the sunset, that's all for naught. So we really need to pass this bill to continue our negotiations with them to avert a standoff, which isn't good for the guides, the charter boats, or enforcement officers in either state. So we feel that the bill is essential, first and foremost, to remove the sunset, and then the amendments are essential so that we can avoid charging an additional fee to the guides that fish the lower river, and we would ask for your support of the bill and the fee waiver amendment.
Thank you. Any questions? Or
I will have a question, but I'll defer. I'll wait until.
Okay.
I'll
okay. Go ahead. Either one.
My name is Jack Glass. I'm a resident on the Columbia River and have fished this area for some time. I actually live in Troutdale area, but I do fish down in Astoria and below the Lewis and Clark Bridge. I'm supporting Northwest Guides and Anglers Association, and as well as I'm team leader of all the G.I. Joe guides, a retail store in Oregon and Washington, G.I. Joe's. We have a current list of guides from Seattle to Medford, and I help coordinate and organize the guides and keep them up with licensing and insurance and all that, make sure they're qualified to be part of this program. Well, this has been kind of a touchy area because we as river guides, many of us, don't have the charter boat license. And so we work the river with our Coast Guard licensing and state licensing, insurance and everything. We're qualified to be doing this. But because of the state of Washington's reciprocity or this ruling of a demarcation line, I should say, in the Columbia River. It's actually a line kind of goes down the Washington shore. You can't go over that line or you have to have a charter boat license. This was written many, many years ago. And so we're trying to turn it around because anywhere else in the Union, in the nation, if you go outside into the ocean, the demarcation line is right at the mouth or the entrance of the river. When you go into the ocean, that's when it requires different licensing like charter boat and that sort of thing. This is the only place that the demarcation line is actually up in the river 10 miles, and it's just along the Washington shore. You can't even see where the line's at. There's no buoys that tells you where it's at or anything. It goes up to that bridge, which is 10 miles up into the mouth. Approximately from one area, 200 yards offshore to just a quarter mile offshore on the Washington side. You don't know where that line's at. So should you go across that line with a river license, theoretically, you could get a citation for doing that. What I'm supporting here is the Bill 2072 is to help resolve this issue. We have fished down here for many years. I have no intentions to go in the ocean. I don't have the Coast Guard license to go out into the ocean. I just would like to have this charter boat license to allow me, in case I should go over that line, which I can't tell where it's at, that I'm not going to get cited or have any issues. This is kind of a quick fix that Paul has come up with that I think would help relieve a lot of these issues until negotiations continue on with the state of Washington to where we can move this line out to the actual ocean where it should be. Any questions?
Thank you. Do we want to wait and, well, stay there?
Yes, ma'am. Certainly will.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Paul Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of the small businesses of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association. Our professional guides and outfitters and their respective businesses serve every region of the state, from our coastal waters to the high desert of Oregon's rugged mountain eastern regions. Today we're here to testify in support of House Bill 2072 with the Dash 1 amendments. Our goal here is to find a workable solution on the issue of reciprocity in the Columbia River. This legislation will give the Oregon Marine Board the flexibility they need to represent Oregon's guides and outfitters' best interests, and they've done an excellent job in this process of looking out for us. This winter, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife established a permanent administrative rule that failed to recognize that an outfitter guide registration is equivalent to an Oregon charter license or a Washington charter license. This administrative rule created a lot of angst and frustration within the guide community, as you can imagine. And despite this tension, we realize that building a wall in the Columbia River is not the answer. Our goal is to seek true reciprocity with Washington. In Oregon, guides and charter boats are required to operate by a U.S. Coast Guard licensed operator, carry liability insurance, and have the proper safety equipment with them. They're engaged in the same activity of carrying passengers for hire, and they pay the same fee for registration. The only significant difference between an Oregon charter license and an outfitter guide registration here in Oregon is the ability to operate in the Pacific Ocean. This difference is not an issue in distinguishing between a charter boat and an outfitter guide in the lower Columbia River, where we're seeking reciprocity. As a result, we're asking you to support House Bill 2072 with the Dash 1 amendments to give the Oregon State Marine Board the ability to waive the fee so that guides and outfitters have the equivalent status on the issue of reciprocity with their counterparts in Washington. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Question. Representative Butler.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. To Paul Donhafner, Paul, your testimony indicates that we don't have any issues with Idaho with regard to this particular licensure issue and the reciprocity. And I appreciate that. I just like to express my angst over the concerns that Idaho sometimes comes in and attempts to collect a sales tax on my Oregon guides and outfitters who will take off from Oregon and stop at various places as they head downriver, some of which may be on the Idaho side as for stopping points. But that is of concern to me because the toll never runs on those sales taxes, and they can come back and collect 10 years at a time of sales taxes that really were never there, that should never have been there. So, and that can virtually destroy my guides and outfitters in that process, and the anglers, the folks that take them out to angle along that river. So I just encourage you to use whatever powers of persuasion that you may have from the Marine Board to encourage the state of Idaho not to create border war problems in these kinds of manners. And we probably have the same problem if we have guides and outfitters that accidentally flow across this invisible line that Paul was talking about. My concern is that then that could create a sales tax issue for these folks that are out guiding Oregonians, leaving from Oregonian ports and never having any intention of stopping into Washington, and yet ending up 10 or 15 years later with 10 years worth of unpaid sales tax returns, which could break them. So just need to make sure we address all of those items at the same time. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. I know that there's an amendment being drafted, but we don't have that yet, I assume. Oh, we do have the amendment. Right, yeah. Okay, so...
And the effect of the amendment, Madam Chair?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Butler, the -1 amendments, and you have also a hand engrossed version of those, allow the State Marine Board to adopt rules to waive the annual fees for those persons who possess a current Oregon outfitter and guide registration and those that operate on the lower river. It also adds an emergency clause.
And it sounds like, Madam Chair, that this will accomplish, and by the insertion of the emergency clause, because you do have a situation here with the season ongoing,
right.
Sounds like it could be the resolution to the things that Paul Don Hafner in his testimony had indicated were problems. So I would encourage the chair and the members to proceed with that and work towards the work session.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. I close the public hearing on House Bill 2072, and I open the public hearing on House Bill 2273.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 2273 is the billboard bill. It modifies definitions of nonconforming sign, reconstruct, and relocation applicable to those signs. It deletes provisions for business identification signs, waiver, on-premise signs, and directional signs. It also revises the mandatory requirements to remove and pay just compensation for legal signs. It changes that to a permissive status. It allows the issuance of investigative demands by the Department of Transportation. The measure also authorizes the issuance of permits for outdoor advertising signs placed on benches or shelters for use by customers of mass transit districts. It further then prohibits outdoor advertising signs on all scenic byways. The measure would declare an emergency effective upon passage. We have received a no revenue impact and waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Before we get started, I do want to let everyone know that our intention after the hearing today is to set this up into a work group. So if that, you know, is and we'll appoint one of our members to that, to chair that. And people who are interested in participating will need to get in touch with Judith to find out and to let us know who is wanting to participate. I get this one. We have a lot of people, and I think one of the things I'll probably maybe bring two or three up at a time, just remember that we don't want to repeat ourselves. If you have new stuff to add, that's great. So I'll go ahead and start the public hearing, and thank you for all your cooperation. I'm first going to call Amy Joyce up.
Madam Chair, just a question of staff. How does this fit together with the Supreme Court decision that affected the overall signs issue in the state of Oregon? That's what we're going to hear first?
That's what we're going to hear first. Thank you for the question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Amy Joyce. I'm the Outdoor Advertising Sign Program Coordinator for the Department of Transportation. I appreciate the opportunity to come here and talk today about this fairly complex bill. By way of introduction, the state regulates signs that people place on private property where they're visible to state highways. This bill, the thrust of it is to address the March 2006 Oregon Supreme Court decision that did away with our permit system, which is our primary enforcement mechanism, and therefore puts in jeopardy significant federal highway funding. The bill will essentially change the way we classify signs so that we can meet the constitutional requirements of the court and put a regulatory system back in place to keep us in compliance with federal highway. By way of background, the bulk of Oregon's sign regulations come to us from the 1965 Federal Highway Beautification Act, often known as the Lady Bird Johnson Act, to regulate billboards. What the law says, in effect, is states have to enter agreements with Federal Highway Administration for regulating signs as to spacing, size, zoning, that sort of thing. And if we don't keep what's called effective control, as the feds see it, we risk losing 10% of some of our annual highway funding. For Oregon, we estimate that to be $25 to $30 million per year in lost funding. Oregon does go somewhat beyond those federal minimums. For instance, Oregon regulates all state highways for signs, and that's a little bit further than the federal requirements go. Existing statutes, and this is going to talk before the state Supreme Court ruling, so what's on the books right now. The primary distinction we make in sign regulation is between on-premise and off-premise signs. Roughly, on-premise means the sign is advertising what's going on there at the location, and off-premise means it's advertising something going on at a different location. A billboard is a typical example of an off-premise sign, but is not the only kind of sign. The location is the question. Off-premise signs under the state sign code need a permit from the state, and to get that permit, you have to meet all kinds of zoning, spacing, size regulations. On-premise signs do not need a permit from the state and only have to meet some basic safety types of regulations, but frequently they're also regulated by the local jurisdiction, the city or the county. Oregon has also has a unique permit system. It's referred to as a cap-and-replace system. So in 1975, when the Legislative Assembly passed this version of the law, they said there are to be no new off-premise sign permits. The signs that were legal at that time were allowed to stay in place, received permits, and from that date forward, what you could do if you had one of those sign permits, you could get a permit to reconstruct that sign at the same location or get a permit to relocate it to a new spot if it meets all the zoning and spacing and other regulations. But if you don't have one of those permits, you can't go and build a new sign. And that's acted as a cap on the total number of signs next to state highways. That system has also created something we call the Relocation Credit Bank. The bank consists of when one of those legal permitted signs is taken down by the owner for loss of lease or whatever reason, and they don't immediately relocate it to a new site, that permit can be banked for future use. ODOT keeps records of that, all of those locations, and there are roughly 700 credits in the bank at this time, and those are individually owned permits at this time. We also have two different kinds of permits that do come into the bill, so I want to address them as way of background. directional sign permits. You have to be a special kind of location to qualify for one of these, a cultural, educational type of location, of particular interest to out-of-state motorists, that sort of thing. If you qualify for that, you might qualify to get a directional sign permit. And a second of our special permits is a business identification sign for folks who aren't located, fortunate enough to be located right on the highway. If they're not visible to the highway, they might qualify for this kind of sign to direct motorists to come off the highway and come to their business, church, location, whatever it is. So in March of 2006, the Oregon Supreme Court ruled that we could no longer require permits on off-premise signs. The court said basically because we don't require them on on-premise signs, we can't require them on off-premise signs. They determined that that was a content-based sort of delineation and found that that ran afoul of Oregon's free speech clause in our state constitution. But we can, the court said, continue to regulate for size, spacing, zoning, that sort of thing. So what this bill does is address that court decision and change our classification system of signs to try to meet what the court is requiring. What we would do now is do away with the on-premise, off-premise distinction and go to a two-tiered sort of analysis. The first thing we would do under the bill, looking at a sign, is ask whether that sign is being posted for compensation. So as an example, a billboard, obviously somebody is paying the sign company to have their advertisement up there for a month. There's compensation changing hands. That sign will need a permit. But also, if there's a ground lease or easement being paid for the placement of a sign, that too is for compensation, that sign needs a permit. So that's our first analysis, is it for compensation? The second leg of the analysis is, will that sign be posted at some sort of business location, regardless of what the copy is on the sign? If the sign is out in the middle of a field someplace, that sign needs a permit. So, again, a for compensation sign or a sign that's not at some kind of business location is going to need a permit under this new system. Most of the other regulations would stay the same under the bill. The cap and replace system remains. The zoning, the spacing, the size regulations all remain the same as the bill is proposed right now. Something else the bill would do, as the department is proposing it, is to do away with any new directional or business identification sign permits. The department is taking a conservative position here. Our concern is that for these directional and business identification signs, we tell folks what they can put on that sign. They can put their name and they can put directions. So we do have a content criteria on those signs. Our concern is that if the Supreme Court had a content-based problem with the on-premise, off-premise distinction, they're likely going to have a problem with us telling folks exactly what they can put on the sign. So in an effort to not be put back in the same situation we're in today, which is roughly a year of having little to no control over signs because of a negative Supreme Court ruling, that would come out of the statute and we would lessen our litigation risk. We've been talking with Federal Highway Administration essentially since right after the court opinion came out, because obviously this is a concern about federal funding and staying in compliance with the FADS. We shared with them the legislative concept and now in bill form. And what Federal Highway has been telling us is that they have some concerns about the concept, and that's basically because it's completely new. You should know that under the federal statute or federal law, and every other state in the union does this on-premise, off-premise distinction that we're now not able to do. So on a statewide basis, Oregon is in the position of coming up with something out of whole cloth, something brand new, and it's somewhat daunting. But what the feds have said is we're going to let you give it a try, and if after a time we find that you're not keeping this effective control that we require, we're going to come back and tell you to take another stab at it, and the risk of loss of federal funds would be there. But I will say that in dealing with Federal Highway and all of this, They've been very cooperative and offering assistance where they can and have not been threatening punitive measures. They also expect that we get something done here and get our regulation back under control. So in summary, state sign laws need to be amended to enact a constitutionally sound system that includes regulations that meet those federal requirements. If not, we risk losing $25 to $30 million per year in federal highway funding. HB 2273 is a new sign classification system, and we believe it's going to meet federal requirements, and it's going to meet the stated state policy to keep Oregon's highways safe and beautiful. And I am ready for your questions.
Thank you. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Buckley.
Okay. Okay, you're next.
Thank you, Representative Butler. On page 3, Amy, there's the comment that we expect the number of signs under the cap to increase because signs that are now legal but did not have a permit under the old system would be grandfathered in. Just to clarify, are we talking then that these are signs that have been put up since the Supreme Court decision, between the time the Supreme Court decision and the time we enact new regulations, or am I off on the time?
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, that's exactly right. There are signs going up now. Some of them are going up in legal spots. Some of them are going up in what we would consider to be illegal spots. But without a permit system, nobody has to come to me ahead of time and let me know. Some folks are doing that and getting checked out whether their spot is going to be legal. But yes.
Just a quick follow.
Yes.
But those signs being added now are still under county or city jurisdiction regulations.
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, yes, they are.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. This is just a follow-up from what Representative Buckley was, where he was going. In that same paragraph on page 3, it indicates leaving these provisions leaves it at risk, that we've been at risk for the last 10 months without tools to control these signs. How many new signs have gone up during the last 10 months since we've had the authorization of the Supreme Court to go ahead and open the floodgates, Amy?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, that's a little difficult to say. I am aware, my office is aware of, I would say, in the neighborhood of 30 new signs. That's a rough number. I can get you more exact numbers. But, of course, without anybody having, folks don't have to come to me ahead of time. So it's a matter of if they're observed and somebody contacts me, whether ODOT staff or a citizen complaint, that's how I find out about these things in most cases.
Follow up, if I may. Amy, when they've got 700 signs banked, that is, there's locations for 700 legal signs that are held off of the market, probably for a profit motive to keep the prices of advertising, outdoor advertising, high, then these 30 signs couldn't be a tremendous impediment to the overall system, because basically what's happened, without using the bank credits that are held by a handful of companies, these relocation credit bank folks, of the 700 signs, basically 30 signs have gone up. I don't know that that's really the floodgates opening up like it sounds like it was.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, the bank represents possible permits. You still have to find a legal site to be able to use that banked credit. So while the 700 credits in the bank represent 700 potential signs, the question is, are there legal sites? And my answer is, some of the signs going up in this interim period are in legal sites and some are not.
Okay, and just a final observation, if I may, Madam Chair. This, again, is all predicated upon a system from 1975, over 30 years old. We've got other things in state law that are 30-plus years old, including land use planning and things like that need to be tweaked from time to time. I guess my question would be, is there any discussion to come back and take a look at what the 1975 Legislative Assembly did with regard to some sort of a freedom of advertising? And I guess I ask that question based upon the fact that as I travel from one state to another, in some states I see more signs, some states I see less signs. Are other states putting in jeopardy their federal highway funds? And I'm wondering if the loss of commerce and business to the state of Oregon is really worth the $25 million that we might just have to cough up back to the feds.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I'm sure it's worth looking back to the legislative history to the 1975 legislature as we work in the work group and see where they were headed. In terms of other states, there are four or five states that don't allow any off-premise advertising. Alaska is one of them, Hawaii is another, but at any rate, of those 45 or so remaining states that regulate signs but allow them, Oregon does have some of the tighter regulations. Our cap system is unique, or at least very rare, and per highway mile that we regulate, we probably have some of the fewest signs in the nation, I think in the legislative statement in the statute as to the policy, part of it is to curb a proliferation of signs. So there is a policy statement in the ORS 377-700 series.
Madam Chair, I take it from the comment from Ms. Joyce is that basically this unique and very rare system that we have in the state of Oregon that's over 30 years old now maybe ought to be a different scrutiny of a different Supreme Court at some point, but I'd like to know that Oregon's system of banking these credits and companies holding 700 credits off the market, 700 signs potentially, and I look at it and I say I count on signs. They're valuable to me because I really don't do road maps very well. I don't have GPS just yet, so at this particular point I count on road signs, and when one of them goes down that says, hey, it's only 12 more miles to Umatilla and you'll be able to get gas there, I think that's important. It's important, I think, to the economy of the area as well. And I'm wondering if 700 bank signs and the fact that Oregon has a unique and rare system maybe is actually costing our economy the $25 or $30 million that we're talking about in a biennium here. Thank you.
Any other questions from...
Just a quick comment to clarify.
Yes.
Just on taking off on some of the Representative Butler's thoughts, the information presented by Amy Joyce does include the types of signs that are being discussed, and the official ODOT signs, of course, about entering cities, etc., are not subject to these regulations, nor are the gas and lodging signs, the welcome center signs, etc., just to note. And on the 30 signs that might have come up since the Supreme Court ruling, my only concern really is that they might all be for the Oregon Lottery, and that's my concern.
Now having exceeded a $1 billion profit.
Right. I do have one quick question, and that is, Oregon is different in that our freedom of speech laws are a little more strict than other states are. And I was wondering if that played into this decision at all, or are other states in line for the feds to come down on them?
Chair Beyer, I appreciate you asking that question, and I think Representative Butler alluded to it, and I failed to answer that part of his question as well. You're exactly right. This court ruling was based on the Oregon Constitution's freedom of speech guarantee, which pretty much everybody is going to tell you goes further than the federal First Amendment. So that was the basis of the ruling, and other states have faced First Amendment challenges before. It's gone to the U.S. Supreme Court and has not been successful years ago. So I think probably other states could face freedom of speech challenges just as they have in the past, but Oregon does have that particular portion that we're sort of, I guess, stuck with in this situation.
Okay. Thank you, and hopefully you plan on sticking around. And
Madam Chair, one quick question, if I may.
Yes.
Actually, one clarification and one question. Did you say, Amy, that one credit is one sign, regardless of the size and location? So 700 credits is 700 signs.
Chair Beyer, Representative Reed, that's roughly right. One credit would represent one size sign. There is a maximum size in the statute, but one credit, one sign, essentially, yes.
And one
yes, follow-up.
Follow-up question that's not entirely on the same subject. Could you say something more about the conversations that have gone along with the feds, what the timing might be? We talked about the risk and so on, and it sounded like you were saying they've been generally accommodating of the proposal, but when, if this proposal were not enacted or some version that met the test, what our time frame might be in terms of the risked money?
Chair Beyer, Representative Reed. They have not told me or other members of ODOT, executive levels of ODOT, who've been very involved in this process and with Federal Highway, have not stated any kind of definite timeline. I will tell you my expectation is that they expect something to happen this session. In terms of assuming some version of this or some regulation gets passed and they give us time to work on it, it's going to take some time to see how the whole thing fleshes out, see how we can enforce it. They know that, well, as of the moment, our legislature only meets every other year. So, again, they've been trying to work with us and not taking a threatening stance. So I would expect that to continue and to receive lots of warnings before any kind of official letter came out, which is the process that happens when a state does get in trouble this way.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before I call the first person on the list up, I just want to make sure if there's anyone in the audience that's come from more than 100 miles. So, seeing none, well, we'll get started. Chris Daughtry, Hasina Squires, and Corey Shumway. You want to all come up?
Madam Chair, I should declare a conflict for the record. I lease sign locations to sign companies on commercial properties.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a conflict here?
I do not have a conflict on this one.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Hasina Squires, and I am here on behalf of the Icon Group, Lamar Outdoor Advertising, Dale Clark Signs, and Torrey Outdoor Advertising Association, and both of those gentlemen are seated behind me, and they're owners of the companies. I'm here today to present testimony on House Bill 2273. With me today is Chris Doherty, the business development manager for Icon Group, and seated to my right is Corey Shumway, who is the general manager of the Oregon Outdoor Advertising Division for Lamar. My clients collectively develop and maintain outdoor advertising signage for commercial and industrial landowners and to small and large businesses throughout the state of Oregon. Our outdoor advertising signs provide revenue to landowners in the form of lease agreements and offer valuable affordable advertising services to small and medium business size owners. Advertising messages on our signs are diverse and range from marketing your local car dealer, national telephone service, local art museums, and regional political charitable organizations. Our testimony below outlines several points that we'd like the committee to consider. We collectively support the intent of House Bill 2273, but we have several concerns regarding the proposed language and the details within the statutory definitions that are currently contained in House Bill 2273. We've communicated to ODOT that we'd be willing to sit down and discuss those issues, and they've been very receptive to that, so I think that there won't be any issue with that. We believe that some of the language is vague, it's ambiguous, and furthermore, we have an issue with what we believe to be the need for an amendment to this current legislation to address antitrust, anti-competitive, and unintended monopolistic behavior that's currently occurring in the sign industry place. I won't go over the background since Amy did a fabulous job of going through. I won't belabor that, and I'll let, there's a lot of other people here that like to testify today. We, our issue with the bill and what we'd like the committee to consider really does focus around outside of the definitional issues. This issue and mechanism of the bank and the current monopoly that exists. We think that it's one thing to limit the overall number of permits, but it's also that it's completely unacceptable to do it in a fashion that facilitates the suppression of competition in the state of Oregon. So, with that, I'm going to turn it over to Chris and allow him to expand on the testimony that's before you.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Chris Doherty, and I am the business development director for the Icon Group LLC, and. Once again, I agree. Amy did a wonderful job of setting kind of the background, and I want to kind of expound a little bit on the point that she brought forward, which is the point that the court recognized in the distinction between on-premise and off-premise. It was one of the easier, more blatant issues that was right there in front of you. And then their decision was, wow, that's also a very difficult, as Amy expressed, that's a very difficult issue to really address and figure out in any kind of quick fashion. So let's look at what our remedy is. The remedy was to then go in and say, well, if we don't require a permit, then we're not distinguishing between any types of signs. And that's where they got into talking about the permit, what we call the relocation permit policy, or generally the bank. And that's kind of what I want to spend a little bit of time talking with you guys about today, because that's kind of where the fire or the fuel that started this whole process comes from. Really, there's kind of an idea out there that if you can't compete under the given statute, then you have to find a way to get around the statute. When the original OMIA was put into place, in order for them to track it, they found every sign that met their original definition and gave it a permit number. Those permit numbers were given freely to those particular signs. The intent of that legislation, however, was to allow for those signs to then be able to, or not signs, but those permits to be able to be moved around. Those permits are not in any way permanent fixtures to those structures. Those permits can change in size upon relocation. They can change from single-face to double-face permits upon reconstruction. There are several characteristics about a permit number that can change depending upon the standards or the policies of which you're operating within the overall statute. Somehow, along the way, the policy began to say, well, okay, the owner of this sign removed their sign voluntarily, and we need to track that one sign has come down in our overall cap. We have a total number of signs, and we don't want any more than that. But within that overall cap, how do we track the movement? How do we make sure it doesn't exceed it? And how do we know what's come down? There are characteristics within there that a permit cannot exceed 100 miles from its original point. Where that original permit was placed on that original sign, you can't move that permit over 100 miles away. So they had to come up with a pretty complex tracking system. When the sign is taken down, the permit is then, the ODOT is then notified that this permit is no longer in the form of a sign structure. There's a number assigned called a relocation credit. Unfortunately, that relocation credit is then also assigned a name of the person that put in there. So that person or entity is the only entity that then can take that credit and utilize it to an otherwise legal spot. That is where you come to what I think is the real crux, ultimately, that would be where you face jeopardy again if we do not address this bill. Getting away from the on-premise and the off-premise distinction is very good. It is necessary. We need to figure out a good way to do that. Ultimately, though, you have within the overall policy of the relocation credit bank an antitrust issue. An unintended consequence where there's an antitrust issue that has been presented for the last 30 years. And that, simply put, by our good lawyers, is called the bank suppresses competition by limiting the overall supply of permits to those, it is the bank facilitates the suppression of competition by private parties with respect to the remaining permits. Suppressing competition overall is okay. Historically, that's been allowed. Federal government, local, state government has found that, you know, there are other policies more important than the creation of new billboards. However, once you start suppressing the actual people that can operate within the limited number, you then create special classes. That's when you are suppressing competition in an unconstitutional manner, creating an antitrust issue. I'd like to take a minute. We've given you quite a bit of stuff to read through here, and I can see that I don't want to take up all your time reading through all of it. I just kind of like to go to our charts and graphs because I think I can illustrate for you kind of the scenario that's come about under the current situation the last 30 years. So if you'll turn to page 3 with me, we can kind of go through what's happened. If we take ourselves back to the 70s, on the day that the ODOT issued all the permits, which I believe was somewhere just under 2,500 numbers, permit numbers. In the 70s, in that decade, there were, now this represents, for our problem here, I'll just state this for the record, that essentially all of the relocation credits, the majority, 80% of the relocation credits are controlled under current policy by two companies in the entire state. And there are 56 holders of permits. Two out of the 56 holders control 80% of the ability to facilitate movement within the industry or the marketplace. In the 70s, those two companies owned a total of their available credits in the bank. 10% of those went in the 70s. Of their total credits in the bank today, the total credits these two companies have in the bank today, 10% of those, that number went in the 70s. 37% of that number that they have in the bank today went in the 80s. 41% of the total number they have in the bank today went in the 90s. And then an additional 10% in the 2000s. So at the footnote, you can see I say the top two credit holders have held approximately 10% of their combined totals in the bank since the 70s. An additional 37% since the 80s, another 41% since the 90s, and 10% more for the period 2000-2006. A total of 88% of the total credits that they have been held at bay, off of the market, by the two largest companies since the 90s or earlier. This is also another issue that takes us squarely into an antitrust challenge. If we don't fix this, I think we're right back, regardless of what we do with the on-premise, off-premise distinction, we're right back into the same type of challenge, which is where the court really didn't want to have to get to. If we turn the next page to page 4, this is a pie chart that kind of shows the existing inventory. This is existing signage on the street now that's being utilized in the marketplace. Kind of just demonstrates where it is. You can see that there are three companies that own a majority of the inventory. That again is a direct result of not being able to, no other company, no other operator being able to utilize the credits that are sitting in the bank at otherwise legal locations. These companies have the ability to tell landowners, you'll probably hear from some today, it doesn't matter what you want, we're the only people you can deal with, we have the credits. That's an unintended consequence. That's the suppression of competition for the landowners. Marketplace is the same way for the advertisers. If you'll turn with me to page 5, actually, that's kind of a broken apart graph. This is, I think, a broken apart graph of page 4. And I think I'd like to point out as well, you can see there are 264 operators currently in the state. 264 operators amongst all the inventory, and of those 264, the blue, the gray, and the brown are three. Everybody else falls within the other colors in terms of your ability in the market. The last chart we have on page 6 shows the existing credits in the bank and kind of the enormous weighted position of two companies. Of all credits in the bank, that pie chart represents the ownership. You have two of the 56 permit holders, or in percentage numbers, 3.5% of the total number of current relocation credit holders control approximately 81% of the market's ability to promote competition. You know, 3.5% of the total current holders of credits. So we would, you know, in conclusion, we have concerns with the current language under the House bill related to the definitions. We would like to see the bill end up as solid as possibly can constitutionally related to definitions, clear and, you know, clear and objective criteria. However, we really think it's important that the committee take the time to address this issue of competition. And I think there's been a lot, there's been good comments from Representative Butler to that end, and I agree with those comments. We're seeking a level playing field and a statute that can withstand constitutional scrutiny. Other than that, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chris, why do you think these companies, please boil it down for me, why do you think these companies are holding these signs off the market for 20, 30 years? What's the underlying reason for that, do you think?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, several reasons. There are expense issues for the companies. That'll be their number one idea. They'll say that it's a bottom line expense issue for them. They'll say that it's an effort to keep the existing number of signs at a minimum. But in reality, the result, which is what I would speak to, is that the land rent, the ability to hold land rents to the landowners at a low level, is the result. And so I have to say there's a drive there. Land rents are one of the largest line items for any large company. They're in the millions and millions of dollars annually. But in a state like Oregon, they're very low because there just aren't any options. A landowner doesn't matter if you get a bid from two or three or four companies. There's probably only one company that has a credit that will reach your location because, again, geographic 100-mile radius. Or you just don't have any. I have several people call all the time to talk to me about that. You have issues in the marketplace for the price of advertising. In this state, the supply is always far below the demand. I believe Corey would be much better to address the issue, Representative Butler, in a real life related to that. They're a much larger billboard company, and they can really get detailed information on what it's done in the marketplace in terms of pricing.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions, if that's okay. Chris, how many credits are currently in the bank?
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, to my best knowledge with information that I've gained this month from the Oregon Department of Transportation, 717.
And would a time limit on the ability to keep a credit in the bank, would that be a resolution that would address the concerns you're bringing up?
Chair Beyer, Representative Buckley, it would certainly be a legal way to come to a resolution, yes.
Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Representative Buckley's question. Thank you. Thank you. Following up on Representative Buckley's question, I'm sensitive to private industry. Of those 717, would it be possible for staff or for ODOT to let us know how many of those were acquired by acquisition, paying for them, versus how many of those have been held since the beginning of the process? It's one thing if the state permitted it to you and it's a gift from the state, it's a public gift. It's another thing if they've paid cash for the asset. I think that'd be important information to know as we also look at what Representative Buckley's suggesting, or I think implying.
Okay.
Madam Chair, while we have the Department of Transportation assisting us in this, I think one of the comments that's been made is really excellent, and that is that this holding off of these permits off the market unreasonably, it creates a loss of landowner value, in effect. And my concern is if, in fact, Oregon is artificially low because of this monopoly as to the values that landowners are receiving, I'd like to have the Department of Revenue, or the Department of Transportation tell us what other states, what the rents are in other states that are actually being paid to the landowners. Because if landowners are being unreasonably treated in this process, we need to know that. That creates another property right loss, as a result of this archaic system that we seem to have developed 30 years ago. So I'd like to have the department respond to that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to remind everybody that, you know, we're here right now until 5. So,
no, 6 o'clock evening.
I haven't gotten permission for that yet. So we'd like to get through to everybody. So keep that in mind, and we'll try to.
My name is Corey Shumway. I'm the general manager, vice president of Lamar Outdoor Advertising Company here in Oregon. Lamar is, I would say, is the third largest outdoor company in the world, perhaps. Certainly, it's the largest solely outdoor company in the country, only second behind Viacom/CBS and Clear Channel. Prior to being with Lamar, I was with OB Media for 15 years. I came from the base level of being small to medium business, and frankly, that's why I got in this business, is because in today's media world, it's so hard for the small business to compete. This was really an exciting opportunity to do that. And outdoor advertising is becoming one of the main growing medias in the country, specifically for small to medium business, because it's getting so hard to compete. That was very exciting for me. In the 15 years that I was with OB Media, we were a small organization, and really our ability to grow and compete was non-existent. I mean, we really had, you know, at any given time, maybe one permit to grow with. And we would beg and plead and try to get permits wherever we could. And depending on who liked it and who didn't, it was successful or not. When Lamar acquired OB Media and myself, I was excited at two things. One, that Lamar had the same business philosophy as OB Media, which was small to medium based business, whereas the two larger organizations, really their business model is centered around national regional business. So it was really a good fit for our company as we folded in. When that transition occurred, I was excited that, you know, over the 15 years that we had been unable to grow, now I had this organization behind me that certainly had fiscal health and resources available that I hadn't in the past, that surely would afford me the opportunity to grow my company. That has absolutely not been the case. We have been just as stifled as before, and I would say more fiercely. Unfortunately, I think we all wanted to come to this meeting with the Outdoor Association of Oregon, but this issue in itself literally divided the association, and I would say that that association, as far as I can tell, has imploded under this issue and separated the group. That's unfortunate. We're hoping to repair that and come back to the table later, but as of this juncture, the Outdoor Association is not representing in this group. I can tell you that in those 15 years, I have never met a person in this industry who did not believe that codes and regulations and guidelines were a good thing. We all want that. That preserves our asset. We also, I've never heard of anyone claiming they wanted more signs than what were capped back when it was originally capped. And I know this, I can't speak for other companies, but I know that, you know, of the illegal signs and legal signs, I would venture to guess that most of those signs would not have been built had there been another opportunity that those folks could have done it in a format that they didn't feel paralyzed. The impact at a local level, and I will apologize, I'm fairly simple-minded, straightforward with the customer, and I look at it from a very street-level basis. The asset, in my interpretation, is that the permits were never intended as an asset. The permits were a right to have a sign, and when the limitation came into effect, the state, in essence, said you can have this many signs in the state. If they come down, others can go up. The word your sign and your permit somewhere got added in there. They're not somebody's permits. They're the state's. And it's just like a building permit. If you want to build a house, you can apply for a building permit. Only right now, if somebody else owns all the building permits, you can't even apply. So what we're asking is that the committee take away that unintended circumstance where it has suddenly become a calling shotgun on permits. It is literally stifling the economy of our industry. The direct result of that is that, Representative Butler, you asked why would they hold those permits. I can't speak for them, but I can tell you what I believe is absolutely happening, which is that, first of all, you can build signs in Oregon. So if you had 700 permits, why wouldn't you build one? The return on the investment, this is a good business. So I don't believe that it's because they can't afford it. I watched their bottom line. I believe that the reason that they don't build signs is for a number of reasons. One is that they get to control the supply and demand, and they get to control the growth of their competitors. I will have customers on a daily basis come to me and ask me for a billboard in Portland. And they'll say, I want to buy 5 billboards in Portland, and I want to cover the area. And I say, well, I only have one in West Portland because I can't build anymore, but it's a really good sign. And they'll say, great, we love, that's a great sign, we'll take it. Then they go to one of my competitors who have, I just want to note, out of 2,450 signs that are allowed in the state of Oregon, I'm the third largest company in the country. I have 38. That same company will then go to our competitor and say, I need 4 other signs in this other part of town to get my coverage. And I have been told by my customers that they've been told, look, if you buy one sign from them, your price is here. If you buy all your signs from me, we'll give you this deal. I can't compete. I'm out of the deal. I walk away, and that's the end of it. Now, I deal with occasional national customers, and I, you know, when it comes to that kind of thing, I just absolutely cannot compete. But on a local level, I still face the same issues. I can also say that from a acquisition standpoint, you know, were these acquired? I can tell you that every single one of these were acquired. And the reason for that is because our industry is just like anybody else's industry. It's been gobbled up upon gobbled up upon gobbled up. I don't imagine that will change. What has been exciting is that there's been continual growth in segmented areas so that there's a health of competition. I'm the first one who appreciates competition. Frankly, it drives my prices up as well. From a landowner perspective, oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible for you to contact a competitor and say, I'd like to buy one of your permits?
Absolutely. Over 15 years, I have made many, many attempts. I think one of the last offers that we had discussed was over $100,000 for a permit. I have to decide how much I can pay the landowner for the rent. If I'm paying $100,000 for the permit, my landowner is going to get about $12 because I can't afford to pay anymore. You know, the sign itself costs about $70,000 if you're building a big one. So, and it's all driven by whether they're feeling like it, whether it's going to work to their favor. I've had many times where they have been willing to sell, then in that same circumstance, they control another situation. For example, there are permits that are being rented out to companies, and we want to acquire a company. I come in and say, okay, if I can't build them, I'll find another guy who maybe is looking to get out of the business. Well, he's got permits that are tied up with these other two big guys, and I go in, I say, I'll give you this much money for your company so that I can continue to grow. Well, he gets a phone call from these other competitors, and they say, no, you're not going to sell to him, and in fact, you'll sell to us. We'll sell at this price, or we'll take our permits back and your signs come down. I have been uninvolved in many acquisitions because of that circumstance. I can say that the landowners, we have landowners call us all the time who say, I'm unhappy with my current lease, and I would like to try to negotiate a new arrangement. And we simply say, I am sorry, but one, as an industry, we're very respectful of each other. We don't jump each other's leases. But two, we don't have any permits, and we can't help you. I have a landowner this happens all the time, who wants a sign. They've got a legal spot, and they keep calling me, and I say, I'm sorry, I don't have any permits. I can't lease one for you. And because they may be in a rural area that doesn't fit within the national, regional business of these other two models, there's no interest to build a sign there. So what's the landowner's choice at that point? It is nothing. They've got no choice. So you know, from our perspective, the intent behind the relocation credit was never intended to be a tool of leverage. It was intended that if you lost your asset because it had to come down through a loss of a lease, that you would have a chance to put it back up. And no one on this panel is arguing that. I mean, we want that as much as the next person, but you're hoarding it. And that's not what the intent was. The state created that policy outside of the regulation. That's not written in the code. It was just the way that it was managed. And all that we're recommending is that the language be adjusted and amended so that they have ample time to get the signs back up if they're going to take them down, a reasonable period of time, and if they're not interested in putting them back up, then they are released of that permit, and that becomes the state's property, and we will not exceed the 2,450 signs. Under some of our recommendations as well, we wouldn't need to raise the cap because current sign permits would be applied to any of these that are grandfathered in. So, you know, we're not interested in having, you know, more than 2,450 signs in Oregon. You know, Amy pointed out herself, you know, when asked, are 700 signs going to go back up? No, probably not, because the local code and county restrictions do not allow it. And so those restrictions are still there. I've been told my corporate headquarters that the threat of federal funding being pulled, and I've talked with the Outdoor Association of America, is something that's been thrown around a lot throughout the country, and it's only been exercised twice back in the 1970s and maybe once recently in a threat and then got turned around. I can't speak for anyone saying that that's not going to happen, but I think that as long as the committee is working towards a solution, that is not going to be a major risk. They want to know that we're working towards a solution, and it sounds like a work group is in order. We are in high support of that work group and want to offer our help in any way we can. What we want from our end is good, healthy, positive regulation of signs that encourages responsibility but has stability to it. I, you know, one of the luxuries of joining Lamar is that they have an extensive legal team. Not one of my most exciting parts of the business, for sure. In fact, I prefer not to be involved in that. But what this legal team is telling me is that there are some very serious constitutional risks with some of the language that's been changed. That doesn't mean it's not salvageable, but we need to spend a little time tweaking it so that it is going to hold up constitutionally, or we're going to be back here. I don't think that it's a wise move to have us experiment for a couple of years. The next time around, it's going to be even worse. So we need to tweak that, and we'd like to offer our assistance for that. And Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for giving me a voice. Sorry to ramble.
Thank you.
Yeah, I would just point out, Madam Chair, sympathetic and definitely an issue we need to look into. This issue is not unique. Commercial salmon fishermen have the same exact issue in terms of their permits, and that once you acquire a permit, it's yours until either, one, you choose not to renew it, or if you sell it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to remind everybody again, we have 10 people. Try to keep it to about 3 minutes, and we should be good. And we might be able to go a little over, but I don't know how much the committee will see what they're willing to tolerate. And the next people is Gary Conkling, Ted Hughes, and Bill Baxter.
Chair by our members of the committee. I'll go first. I'm Gary Conkling, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association, and unlike most of the people sitting behind me, I'm not involved in this other than sort of as roadkill. one of the byproducts of House Bill 2273 is the elimination of directional signs, and the legislature in 1999 authorized the Oregon Viticultural Directional Highway Signs, which is now part of ORS 377.727, and it effectively would be eliminated by the current provisions of this bill. We certainly understand, even better today, I understand after listening to the previous testimony, some of the legal impetus that's brought forward this legislation. But our concern is that we don't really think the court case was about signs that identify winemaking regions in our state, which are related to promotional efforts. I also want to note, as I did, Madam Chair, to you personally, that we don't want to be an obstacle here, and I also want to acknowledge that ODOT was kind enough to acknowledge before the session started that this situation developed. The agency has actually been a good friend of our industry, so I'm here today not with any anger, but just to try to point out that we would like to be involved in any kind of a work group that might find a solution that would allow directional signs to continue, and also to make sure that the existing signs that are out there today on the highways alerting people to different viticultural areas may remain. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ted, why don't you go ahead? We'll go in the order I called you. How about that?
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Ted Hughes representing CBS Outdoor Systems. CBS Outdoor Systems is a branch of CBS Broadcasting. It's the outdoor advertising branch. They are the bad people, from what I just heard a little while ago, because we have a few of those bank permits. And but they were acquired. CBS System, Outdoor Systems, has purchased other companies that had the permits. And I would imagine one of the reasons they purchased those companies is because of the value of those permits, which was the rules and the laws of the time. And so we totally support ODOT's proposal. We think they have done an excellent job under the conditions that existed, and we'd be happy to work in a work group if you like. It's what goes on every hearing room in this building is a search for marketplace advantage. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm Bill Baxter, Bill Baxter Realty. I've been dealing with Lamar signs. I'm putting a sign on Highway 99 in Eugene in a donut shop there, Highway 99 donut shop. And it had quite a bit of unusable land, but it was in a nice location where you could see it well. And I contacted Lamar, and they said, yeah, we would put a sign up there, but we can't do it because we don't have the permit. But as soon as we get one, we'd really like to put one there because it's a good location. And it went on for 2 years. I called up other places, and nobody seemed to help. And it just seemed like they're just... was too much red tape to get it up. And they called me up and said we have a small window that they went back to the old law, and now we can move if we go pretty fast. And so just luckily we just got it up, but it's 2 years of people just waiting there. And maybe there's a better way to handle this. And it's a beautiful location, and the people needed to make some extra money. They had this land that was not being used, and maybe just a little work on the laws might help. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Butler.
I just had one quick question for Ted. Ted, you indicate that CBS Outdoor probably is may well be, and you didn't indicate this. I'm just guessing that may well be one of the companies who has some of the 566 signs credits in the relocation bank, and you're doing that for marketplace advantage. Help me with the marketplace advantage that you might gain by holding those off the market.
No, I didn't mean to say a market. Well, it probably is. It's probably the reason that we don't release the permits willy-nilly. This whole issue here is a turf battle, basically. I mean, we and the other company pioneered the billboards in the state, and God love these people. They're free enterprisers. They got into the business. And if you recall, one of the comments was that if you can't get in the business under the existing conditions, you figure out how to do it otherwise, and that's what prompts this whole rewrite of this bill. I would imagine it's a marketplace advantage to keep these permits, and I would imagine that was part of why CBS Outdoor Systems was interested in purchasing the companies.
Just to follow up, if I may,
yes,
quickly. Ted, the schedule that we're looking at indicates that the 566 relocation credits held off the market, nearly 80% of those, 88%, I guess, have been held off for the larger portion of a couple of decades. Tell me about the market advantage that's gained by doing that.
Madam Chairman, Representative Butler, I can't tell you that, but I can bring some CBS Outdoor advertising people here that can explain that to you. There's got to be a rationale for it.
Okay. I'm just anxious that, you know, for some reason, the Midwest old colloquialism that we remember, that the guy that wouldn't raise pigs and got so much money from the USDA, here we have advertising signs that you don't advertise on and you get paid for it, and I don't understand that concept. Just no different than the concept of raising pigs and not getting paid for it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted, how many permits does CVS hold? Do you have any idea?
I believe the diagram that that panel gave you is correct. The percentage in the diagram is correct. I think they did their homework with that handout.
And just a comment.
Oh, okay.
As most of you know, I'm a dairy farmer originally. We used to have a quota system in Oregon, and we paid for the right to produce milk. Well, in the 80s, we said, no, this doesn't make any sense. It's really a restraint of trade, and I just think we've got something of the same thing going on here.
Thank you.
I just wondered if maybe he was one of those guys that was not raising pigs and getting paid for not raising pigs.
All kinds of stuff like that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ted, I just want to make sure I clearly heard. CBS acquired companies who held these permits with the intent of acquiring those permits.
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, I don't know that for a fact, but I do know the original company in 1975 that had these permits under the old law was 3M National. They were purchased by another company, and then CBS Outdoor recently purchased them a couple years ago. And I would imagine there's the purchase of the company was based somewhat on how many permits. I do not know that as a fact. I'm going to bring CBS Outdoor Systems to the table so that you get the correct answers. I'm not the best witness for that.
If I may follow up, yes, just very quickly. I'm not looking to be lobbied by anyone, but I'm very, very sensitive to free enterprise and to free trade. I'm also very sensitive, though, if you acquired those permits with the understanding that, and you paid cash for those permits with the understanding you would have those into the future until you chose to use them or to sell them, trade them, give them away. I just share this with the committee. I'm very sensitive to that, and I'd be very hesitant to go against what a free enterprise economy would have us do, and that's honor a sales transaction. So.
Madam Chairman, Representative Smith, I don't know the answer to that. I'm assuming that they were part of the reason that the company was purchased to begin with, and you know, every industry has turf battles. Pick an industry. You mentioned the salmon fishing industry permit. Everyone does, and this is another one.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions. Yeah. Okay. Don Jenkins, Suni Hill, and Bill Lockridge. Okay. Well, I called Don up first, so if he wants to start.
I thought maybe we would go ladies first, but Madam Chair and honorable representatives, first of all, let me just say that I have been in this business for 40-something years. I've been through most of the hearings in the early days of some of these ordinances that we're talking about. I think I can give maybe two answers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't catch that. But could you identify yourself and
where
you're
from? Oh, I'm sorry. My name's Don Jenkins, owner of Beacon Advertising. I'm the smallest billboard company in the state.
Thank you.
But I'm the oldest. as a matter of fact, in 1977, the amendment, which is considered the 100-mile distance requirement, that was passed on my behalf, or aimed right at me by the legislature, and not so much the legislature, but you know, the big companies that I had bought a company over in Eastern Oregon. Actually, the headquarters was in Boise, Cosgrove Outdoor, and they had beat up old signs, the old wooden poster signs, most of them fallen down, and I bought it for the permits. And when I gave testimony in the committee hearings back in 77, it finally got around to me after everybody was defiling me for being a scoundrel for bringing all these permits from the other part of the state. But that's what the law allowed, and I was asked that pointed question if that was what the law allowed, and it was. And the good representatives at that time in that committee, they asked me finally at the end of my testimony if, and this might be an answer for you to look in your archives, because there's this talk about permit values in buying companies. And the answer to your question, sir, is that everybody except me has paid for their permits because every company has been acquisitioned at least once, if not three times, in the last 10, 15 years. So they've all been purchased. But in your archives of these meetings back in 77, the pointed question from the chair was, Mr. Jenkins, can you do what you have to do in 90 days, and I was there fighting for my life that day not to have the emergency rider to the bill, which would have made it law the next week or so when the governor signed it. And I said, yes, sir, I could. I mean, 90 days, I could probably handle my business. Because he was concerned, in fact, I'd paid all this money for those permits. And he knew, you know, I was honest about it. So anyway, my answer here to these companies that own all these permits, why don't you ask them? We'll give you 90 days. We'll give you 120 days. Is that enough time? They only gave me 90 days to do my thing, and I had to work fast.
I'm sorry. Can I clarify? 90 days to put up signs, 90 days to use your permit. I'm not following what you're...
To go out and lease new structures, make new applications, get those into ODOT so that ODOT could process them, and then of course, at that point, you're okay.
So may I follow?
Yes, you may follow.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just to clarify, so you're saying ask the other companies, could they in 90 or 120 days make use of their permits?
That's right. In other words, put a cap on their how much longer they can hold those permits. I mean, the cap was put on me by them. I mean, because they were the ones that brought that to the Senate or to the House. They did that to stop me. And I'm not trying to stop them, as if I could. But the point is, does this have to go on indefinitely? Surely when they bought those companies, they looked at the permits as being part of the value, not so the inherent value as being, if we buy this company, we don't have to worry about somebody else building more signs that's going to be a threat to us. I mean, that's an inherent part of it. I'd like to commend... Amy Joyce, myself, because I have all the years I've worked with the department, she's probably the first person that's been, I consider, honest. I'm talking about the department, not you folks. I don't even know you folks. I will admit to you, you're looking at a Republican, so I'm probably in bad shape here. Let's see, it was another thought I had, but I don't want to take any more time, but I...
Okay, you're done.
I'm done. I muffed it. I paused too long. I'm sure there'll be future opportunities.
Oh, goodness.
Are you finished? I didn't good job, really.
I'm going to say I am. I know there was one other thought I had in transit in my mind, but I got carried away with all this other stuff. So. But it's been a pleasure talking to you folks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Sunny. Can you move a little closer, maybe?
I have a little voice.
Yes.
Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Sunny Hill, and I'm a real newbie to the billboard industry. I own one permit, and I lease another with a partner. And I would simply like to echo the concerns of everyone else that has been up here previously, so not to take up your time, but to ask you to please give careful consideration to the language and encourage more black and white and not so much, you know, there are things in the other bill that left ODOT to make the decision. You know, it would be nice if it were specifically written on paper, the decision being made, it's this or this. And thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay.
Madam Chairman and Committee, my name is Bill Lockridge, and I am a partner in the Lockridge Outdoor Advertising Company with my son. Mr. Jenkins kind of ruined my opening statement because I thought I was the oldest dog in this room in outdoor advertising. I started in 1970 with two quarts of paint and a couple lettering brushes. And I have built billboards in, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 14 states and something in the neighborhood of 1,500 of them. In the 14 states that I have done business in, I've never found one that had kind of the unique system that Oregon has with a cap and replace. So this was a major shock to me when I first came into the state. I think it was around 1999. I was given a copy of the regulations, and no one had said anything to me about a cap and replace. And I worked about a month and a half getting leases before I realized that that was the system that was in place. So when this window of opportunity opened up, it looked to me like maybe finally things were going to change here and the mindset was going to allow that outdoor advertising companies could in fact come in and build new billboards keeping with the regulations established, which are great. I agree with Mr. Shumway from Lamar that absolutely, we have to have rules and regulations, and most municipalities throughout the United States today do have some sort of rules and regulations. Even a lot of them prohibit billboards. I think, actually, that decision should really be left up to the local municipalities and not a state agenda. The state agenda should be to comply, certainly, with the Beautification Act. And I have lived underneath this umbrella for 37 years. And as an independent billboard company, I know in all of the years that I've leased properties that I've enriched the property owner. I have created some sort of economic impact that allowed an advertiser to be able to lease a billboard that monetarily, in looking at different advertising industries like newspaper, print media, or whatever, billboards are a very inexpensive, effective way to advertise. And I guess one big question I would like to really ask the committee, and I think Representative Butler hit on it earlier, is what is the economic impact of allowing new billboards to be built? Personally, I'm in all of the years that I've been in this industry and knowing where I built them and the economic activities that have been centered around some of these areas where they've been built is phenomenal. And very, very few of them are ever vacant. They're generally always filled up. I do think this is a supportive, monopolistic situation that we're involved in here. I have moved my entire company here, hoping this would change, and I still hope it will change. I hope that the doors will be open that we can continue to build new billboards. But I would bring to the committee some things that I think maybe you could think about. Maybe instead of a total cap and replace, elimination of letting small businesses come in and participate in building outdoor advertising structures, maybe an increase in the yearly fees, or maybe an initial processing fee that would be a pretty good sum of money to start with. Or even, and I hate to throw this out, but even maybe a percentage of the yearly income. I think the regulations maybe of even smaller billboards, instead of the 800 and some square foot that's presently allowed, maybe we bring that down to 300 square foot. But to keep this monopolistic situation in place, I think, is extremely unfair. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions?
Just one question, Mr. Lockridge, if I may, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for the testimony of all three of you. I think this is very valuable. Mr. Lockridge, and perhaps to Don as well, I'm just looking for the average impact financially of one of these large signs. Would a sign, the impact of having a sign, both in terms of how much you pay for ground lease and how much you pay for, or how much you are paid for the actual the signage itself, posting the advertisement, with the combination of that, how much money are we talking about per month?
Well, in the average, and I can only speak for myself, but mm-hmm. in the average, it's about 20% of our income, our yearly income, that goes to the ground rental. And I'm not so sure that's true with what's happened in the past here. But my philosophy in this business, and I think one of the reasons that I have been fairly successful in this business, is I have always, always felt, and I got a lot of competitors behind me that are going to hate this statement that I'm about to make, but I have always felt in my heart that you have to give to get. And if that property owner has that piece of ground that could be legal and could turn into a permittable situation, and you're going to profit from that, I think they should profit as well. And 20% is probably a little higher than the competitors in this state are probably paying, if you probably look at their bottom line, but it's fair. It's totally fair.
Thank you very much.
Can I ask you, I didn't quite understand your question. You were asking about impact. Do you mean, I didn't quite understand.
Well, one of the, if I can clarify, yes. If I may, Madam Chair, Don, my question is, if I've got one of the signs, and we've had some handouts of various signs, Amy's testimony shows a V sign or an A sign. I'm not sure which it is. I call it a V sign. I think in the industry they call it an A-frame or something of that nature. What would the total impact of that sign? What's the total cost you pay for ground rent and for that someone is paying for the amount or for the advertising itself?
Can I give you an example?
Just an example.
Okay, a freeway sign in a good location costs maybe $65,000 to $80,000 to build.
Certainly.
The land lease might cost anywhere from $2,000 to $4,000
per,
depending on how good it is.
Per year. Okay.
In some cases, I don't want to give away secrets here, but sometimes we pay upfront money, like bonus money to the landowners, to get them to step over that edge. But that's pretty much...
That's per month? Per month for the sign?
How much? Anywhere from on the freeway, anywhere from one... In the rural areas, I'm a rural person, not Portland. In rural areas, anywhere from as low as 1,000 to as high as 2,000.
And so it could be more than that in the urban area?
A lot more than that in the urban area.
Thank you. So I am.
All right, thank you, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Great testimony. I really appreciate the perspective you've brought to this. And I have to tell you, I work with hundreds of business owners, and the philosophy of giving to get is first rate. Quick question for staff. Would it be possible to find out how often these permits are renewed and what the cost of renewing a permit is, just so we have that technical background information? Thank you.
I'd like to just add one last thing, if I could. I know the time. The question about the need for control is really overstated. I mean, in one sense. If you have 700 permits in a bank that's been in there for 20, 30 years, and I can tell you this, that probably some of those permits were not stagnant. I mean, they may have built a sign or two during that time. That sign came down and went back in. So there's probably been some movement in and out. That would be my guess. Since I don't own those permits, I can't say. But I can tell you this, there are not 700 legal locations in the state of Oregon to be built. So there's more permits, actually, in existence that could be flooded out to the market, so to speak, and never used, because there's not that many locations that local jurisdictions would allow building, and you have to have that. So it's this idea that you have to clamp down and hold back the flow of... the only thing you have to do, really, somehow we have to address the question that came from the Supreme Court. And I'm guilty, I'll tell you right now. I built a couple of signs, or three signs, that I'm cited for, because I went beyond the ODOT regulations. And I did it with the fervor of somebody who's been pent up for 30, I live in Oregon for 35 years, and I do beat this gentleman because I started in 1967 as a bill poster, So that's 40 years. But the point is, I was pent up. I did my business in California. I own a small airplane so I can get down there, and back. But I do my business down there because I can build down there. I could sail up here for people that have empty signs, but I like to own signs too, just like everybody else that's in the business. So I've been pent up, and so when this court decision came out, I rushed out and did what I could and took advantage of what I believed to be loopholes in their decision in saying that I could do what I was doing. Now, that will be found out later in court, so we don't know about that. But I think that that's the question that's got to be addressed, is how wrong is ODOT in conjunction with the Supreme Court ruling on OMD versus ODOT? Because there's a big question there, at least to me, and I'm relying on my answers to be, if my answers are not right, I'm dead.
Thank
Can
you.
One little tidbit.
Okay. Identify yourself again, please.
Sunny Hill, the okay. Bright Way.
Thank you.
I own one permit. I would love to own another permit, but somebody needs to open that up so I can have... There, you just can't get them. So, in order to be competitive, I lease one now, but I would love to own my own.
Okay.
And I just
Thank
had
you.
One more question for these small sign owners, if I may.
Yes, sir.
If my sign, and I'm taking it, you folks don't have a lot of signs in the bank right now.
None. None.
Okay. If my sign location is in the relocation bank, and I'm not using it, how much property tax am I paying the local government for that sign?
Zero.
Zero. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Committee, we have four more people. Are we on for... Okay.
Hey. Let's go.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Stan Smith, Kirk Becker, and Mike Reeder. Okay, Mr. Smith, if you want to start.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives.
I'm probably the youngest member in this industry, meaning years in the business.
Well, long 3 years.
I know.
See what it does to you?
Yeah, really.
That's what it does to you.
I'm not getting that.
I'm going to do my best not to be repetitive. I agree with what the people before me have said about the permit and the credit system.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My name is Stan Smith. Stan Smith. The name of my company is Capital Financial Group. So I'm just going to give you really briefly the economic scenario that happened to me last year having to do with the credit system. I went out and found 6 potential sites inside of a city that allowed billboards. I approached the 6 landowners, obtained 6 leases, went through the permit process with the city, was issued my building permits, went through the process. This is before the court ruling. Started the process with the state of Oregon, making sure it was in the not in protected areas, purchase sites, etc. Was going through the entire process. Now became the unknown that we've uncovered here today. Obviously, many of the people here already knew about it, and that was getting the permits. So I went out and ordered from ODOT the list of people who had permits, thinking I'd go out and pay a reasonable price for these permits. Here's what I found out. I went out there, and like most businesses, recurring revenue businesses, they pay you a percentage of revenues. In the billboard business, let's just say, for example, that number is 5 times annual revenues. And that was our starting spot. This is what they put the value of those assets I had. Because I'm a developer, I don't run billboards. That's where they started at. So the first thing they deduct is we're going to deduct 10% for a vacancy rate. So 10% of that gross purchase price came off. The next was 10% for vacancy, 6% for sales cost. That came off. Now they put the value on what their permit was, 60%. So that brought me down to 76% deduction on the gross price, and they said, there's your offer. If you want it, there it is. If not, go somewhere else. Well, there is no place else to go because there are no permits. Okay, it wasn't going to work. With the lease costs I was paying those people, it wasn't going to work. So I ended up finding a company, I won't mention their name, that did have the ability to build 3 signs. They did have 3 permits. They didn't quite put the value on those permits as that because they needed inventory. They ended up getting 3 of those signs. They actually did pay me a number that was reflective of a 60% charge for permits to use their permits, but that's just the way it ended up. There were 3 landowners that didn't get signs on their property. The reason why is there were no permits. So we built 3, and 3 didn't get built. The economics of that, I heard some testimony that we bought those permits, or we might have bought those assets. I really believe that most billboard companies bought assets, meaning the boards that exist, for the recurring revenue. I don't think you're going to find many companies that go and they put a value on the permits what they are today. Sure, they had value, but they were nothing like what it's turned out to be today. They bought it for the revenue on the billboards. That's why they bought companies. And I think they're I won't use any comments, but I think they're pulling our leg a little bit if they're trying to convince us that they really felt the value long-term was in that permit. It's just turned out to be that way when more and more companies are trying to get into the business. Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good evening, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Kirk Becker. I am an owner of a small outdoor advertising company in the Portland area. I came here today. I'd written something very, very quick, and I'll read that in a moment. But in listening to the rest of the folks, we kind of got off onto the credit system and all that, and that's great because I think it's been well received by all of you. This is certainly a story of the haves and the have-nots, and I think we're all the have-nots here. What nobody's talked about since we started talking about the haves and the have-not is the actual bill, the House bill, and the way it was drafted by ODOT. And I'm just going to read this, and then I'll shut up. But what House Bill 2273 does is to eliminate the direct distinction between on-premises and off-premises advertising. In place of that distinction, the bill makes another indirect distinction. It defines an outdoor advertising sign as A, a sign that is not at the location of a business or an activity open to the public, and B, a sign for which the compensation or anything of value is given or received for the display of the sign or for the right to place the sign on another's property. The bill then prohibits permits for outdoor advertising signs. The sole purpose of the distinction is to prevent off-premises advertising. In other words, House Bill 2273 allows an owner to have on the owner's property a sign that advertises the owner's business or activity on the property, but prohibits a lessee of a sign rights to have on the lessor's property a sign no matter what it advertises, and also prohibits a lessee of the entire property for a business or activity to have on the property a sign advertising the lessee's business or activity on the property. The obvious purpose of this is to try to prevent off-premises advertising and also any commercial advertising other than that of the property owner's business. This continues what ODOT has been attempting to do in the past, which is to enforce sign regulations that violate the Oregon Constitution's free speech provisions. I think what the legislature needs to hear on this point is if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it is a duck. The courts won't buy it. And it's about time that ODOT stops trying to violate the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Reed.
Yes, Chair Beyer, members of the committee, I'd like to expand on what was just testified about today. There has been a lot of discussion about the bank. I represent Century Outdoor Advertising. Steve Grover isn't able to be here today. He's in Montana on other business, but he's asked me to speak for Century Outdoor. There are problems with the proposed bill that is in front of you, and we would be more than happy to provide some suggestions for maybe some different language. But the first problem that I'd like to turn your attention to is the language in the proposed language in the proposed House bill, which is it is section 19, subdivision A and subdivision B. First, subdivision A is really a resurrection of the on-site off-site distinction that was ruled unconstitutional by the Oregon Supreme Court. This really is an end run around the actual holding of that ruling. It says, and I see that you're reading it, it says, a sign that is not at the location of a business or an activity open to the public, as defined by the department by rule. Not at the location of a business or an activity are other words for not on premise. ODOT has done nothing to alleviate this unconstitutional problem. It still impermissibly restricts the subject of expression in the violation of Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution. It is still not content neutral. Second of all, it doesn't even achieve the goals that were cited by Ms. Joyce that are found in the policy section of the what we could call the old OMIA. The second subsection, 19B, is also problematic, but for a slightly different reason. It states, a sign for which compensation or anything of value as defined by the department by rule is given and received for the display of the sign or the right to place the sign on another's property.
Page 3. He's actually on page 3.
Right.
This is really section
20. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Right.
So we're really
section 5.
On page 3, sub
719.
Sub 19.
Yes, I apologize. Thank you. So this subsection says, is basically saying that if you get paid for it in any way, then that is prohibited, or you need to get a permit, which has been explained. It's very difficult to get under the duopoly that has been created by the OMIA. This distinction, my question is, how does this distinction of whether or not you receive compensation or not, how does that achieve the goals of the OMIA, ORS 377705? There's a court, Oregon Supreme Court case, Moser versus Frohnmeyer, which the site is 13 OR 372 in 1993, where the Oregon Supreme Court has said that the legislature must identify the harmful effects. The law must be must identify and focus on those effects. Describing an outdoor advertising sign that the person receives compensation for does nothing to further the policy or does nothing to limit the effects that ODOT seems to think needs to be regulated. This is also in violation of the commercial speech protection that was afforded by the U.S. Supreme Court under the First Amendment in Cincinnati, the city of Cincinnati versus Discovery Network. The second point that I'd like to talk about, other than the constitutionality part, is something about fairness. We've heard a little bit of testimony, not very much, about what happens to the signs that were put in the ground between the time that the OMD decision was came down in March of 2006 and the adoption of the revisions to the OMIA. What do we do with those signs that were done, that were approved at the local level, for which ODOT wasn't able to regulate because of the remedy in the OMD decision? We ask that this committee, or if there's going to be a work session, look at how to protect the rights of those who legally established billboards. And I know that there's been some disagreement or some confusion between ODOT and some of the smaller companies as to whether or not a billboard actually is legal under the OMD decision. And I'd be happy to discuss that. I think it's a little off point for this committee, but I'd be willing to discuss that as well. But the point is that those signs that are deemed legal be afforded the same protections or the same rights that we've been talking about the permits that were granted under the 1975 statute. And there are, and I can give you the actual sections. I apologize for the confusion before. There's Section 4, Subsection 1 and 2. That we have problems with, Section 19, Section 5, Subsection 22, Section 6, and I don't expect you to go through these, but I just want to put this out for the record. Section 6.
Madam Chair, perhaps Mr. Reeder could get that to the committee administrator, his notes, as well as the court cases, including the Frohnmeyer court case, and that would be the more effective way of transmitting that information.
Thank you.
And then we could have that all as committee members as well. Thank you, Madam
Thank
Chair.
You.
Chair Byer, Representative Butler, I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you.
That's a great suggestion. I'd just like to close my testimony by saying that there are constitutional problems with this proposed legislation, and if we follow the spirit of the Oregon Supreme Court, really I don't see a way around the distinction. We can make it look like a duck. I'm an Oregon duck. But the Oregon Supreme Court has made that distinction for us. They have interpreted Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution not to allow this type of discrimination. Whether or not ODOT wants it, whether or not there are fiscal impacts, it doesn't matter. The Oregon Supreme Court has ruled, and that needs to be identified in the new legislation. And I would like to just encourage us to provide some fairness, the same fairness that was granted to what people are calling the big boys back in 1975. We'd like to have that same fairness granted to those companies that have placed legal, non-permitted billboards up. Thank you, and I'd be willing to entertain any questions.
Are there any questions? Seeing none. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I would like to, I'm sorry about that, because I know the time, but would it be possible to get the representative from ODOT to answer one question specifically that was just brought up?
Yes.
Would that be all right?
I'm going to bring her up for one, Madam Chair. I've got two or three myself. So.
Well, can I also, our last person that we have is Paul Lindsay. 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 if he wants to come up and testify, and then we can.
Right.
You're fine there. But.
Madam Chairman, thank you for letting me be here. I am one of the homeowners, sign owners, property owners.
Okay.
So.
And identify yourself and
Paul
where
Linsley.
You're from. Okay.
And I'm from Portland, and I have two signs on my property, which started out with Clear Channel. They had a 15-year contract with me, and at the time I wasn't that smart, but the contract was for 1,020 for two signs for 15 years, which averaged $47 a month per sign. And so one of the reasons they probably aren't using these permits is because they're making so much money off the people they already have. But $47 a sign is terrible. But anyway, one of the reasons I'm here is because the contract was over last March, and I waited a year and been unable to write another contract with them. And I've told them to stay off the property, but they still come back. And they did sign one. I signed a contract, but they won't sign it. And so I don't really know what to do, but I feel like there's some real problems here. And I'm representing a lot of people that have signed these long-term agreements that they wish they probably hadn't signed.
Thank you. Any questions?
I just had one question for Mr. Lee. So, Mr. Lee...
Linsley, yes.
I'm sorry.
Linsley,
I beg your pardon. So, Mr. Linsley, if you don't re-sign for a longer period of time, the indication is that they will take the signs down. Is that correct?
Well, they're trying to just give me that. They've had the signs in there for all this time, for almost another year, and they still want to pay me the $47, even though we don't have a contract. But they're saying, yeah, it goes back to the old contract, but it doesn't. I mean, I may have to get a lawyer and all this, but I don't quite understand it, but they also, in their contracts, they have a rollover. If you don't sign off on that a month or two before, then it rolls off and they have another 15 years. It's terrible. I mean, somebody needs to look into this for these guys, and I don't think that you should have a contract over 5 years or 10 years because of the inflation. I mean, I'm a landscaper. I have my own business, and I build waterfalls, and the signs are in my nursery. And I wouldn't have signed a thing for 15 years. I don't even know how it got to be 15. I thought it was 5 years. But anyway, 15 years, I mean, a shovel was $5 or $8 15 years ago. Now it's 55. So it's like the inflation rate. Nobody should sign a 15-year contract with these people.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I was just looking at what the remedy would be so far as what Clear Channel is offering to do. Are they offering to take the sign down?
Yeah, that's what they want to do,
fine.
But they only want to pay me the $47 a month, too, and they've made thousands.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm just wondering if it goes into the bank at that point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
All right, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 5, sub 19, would you like to respond to the interpretation that was just made that this part of HB 2273 actually would make it illegal for a non-premise sign again?
Madam Chair and Representative Buckley, I've got on page 3, sub 19, I have that as the definition of non-conforming sign. Am I in the wrong spot?
That's the one.
Okay.
Could you
all right, thank you.
Kind of give us a talk through what non-conforming sign means.
Okay, yeah, non-conforming sign is a concept where a sign is legal when it's built, but then something changes, whether it's the physical facts or the law changes in some way. So it was legal when it started out, something changes, making it no longer comply with the law, but we call it non-conforming. So it can stay. It doesn't comply with the new law, but because it's non-conforming, it can stay. I'm not sure where Section 19 gets us to anything. And in fact, that's really just sort of a restatement of the way we do things now. Anyway, it's just a clearer definition of what non-conforming means.
Well, I guess just to respond to the, I think the implication of the testimony was that this takes us right back into the same constitutional dilemma that we had before. Any response to that?
Yes, Representative Byron and Chair Byron and Representative Buckley. There may be a misconception there on the part of the earlier testimony. The sign at the location of a business element, that's part of that two-tiered analysis we do under the bill. That's regardless of whatever is on the sign. So let me give you an example that would happen under this situation. Representative Buckley owns a dry cleaner along a state highway. He could have a sign at his location that he puts up himself, isn't paying anybody for it to be there. Now maybe it says, you know, Buckley's dry cleaner, or maybe it says Eat at Joe's 5 miles ahead. That sign is at the location of a business. If there's no compensation changing hands, then you don't need a permit from the state. Now, presumably, if you're allowing Joe to put his Eat at Joe's sign in your lot, you're probably going to charge some money. It's an economic, a legal economic theory, sort of a standard theory under of jurisprudence that folks are generally economically driven. Probably in most cases compensation would change hands, so probably in most cases that sign would need a permit, but not necessarily so. So, you know, I think what the earlier testifier may have been talking about is we are admittedly trying to get roughly to where we've been in the past. Frankly, we want to comply with what the federal government requires of us to keep this $20 to $30 million in funding. But we're going to miss stuff at the edges. It's not going to be exactly the same. It can't be unless we make it exactly the same. But that is a misconception, I think, about the business location element, that it has absolutely nothing to do with what's stated on that sign. It is the physical location of a sign structure.
Thank you.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to continue on. I've got a couple of questions, and now you're talking 20 to 30. Is that 25 to 30 million estimated?
Yes.
Okay. And so I would like to get some definition of how much money is at stake, because if I run my calculations just on 700 sign credits at a few thousand dollars a month, plus the construction of those signs, plus the other economic benefit that could be spun off from that, it may be that we're walking over dollars to pick up dimes, and I'm concerned about that concept. So I need a little better. You just a moment ago used a figure of 20 to 30 million, and your testimony is 25 to 30 million dollars. Where I come from in Eastern Oregon, $5 million is a lot of money. It runs my counties for years and years and years. So I need a little better definition. I'm going to continue on with the Buckley Drive dry cleaners, if I may. If Buckley's dry cleaners happens to have locations all up and down I-5, can he at his Roseburg location, let's see, no, we want to take him down to his Medford location. Okay. Can he at his Medford location then advertise, bring your dirty clothes, bring your dirty laundry to Buckley's at this location and these other five locations? Can he advertise Buckley's all up and down the interstate at that single location, or at any of his locations that have freeway access and visibility?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, that's exactly correct. The physical structure is at a business location. That satisfies element one, and presumably he's not paying himself compensation to put up the sign. That satisfies criteria two. He doesn't need a permit from the state. I'll assume he'll need some kind of compliance with the local jurisdiction, but that's right.
Okay, follow-up then relative to that. If Representative Buckley's Roseburg location is on a leased facility and he's on the freeway and has a 50-year lease, which under the federal law is in fact an ownership, has a 50-year lease, he's paying his landlord every month for that. Can he advertise and continue to pay his landlord for his location?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, I need a little clarification on the question. The lease has to do with the sign structure or his ability to be at that location with his business. Is that what
we're... leases 2 acres for his Buckley's dry cleaners in Roseburg, and he leases that on a 50-year lease. And he throws up a sign there that says, remember, drop your dirty clothes at Buckley's.
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, this is where we get into the real nuances of this statute, where definitely the work group is going to be helpful. What I would say is that at this point, the concept would be if the lease is for Representative Buckley to have his business there.
Unrestricted use to his business.
All right. So the lease, the compensation is changing hands for the sake of him having a business there. The sign is incidental to that. So I think the concept then is the lease, the compensation isn't changing hands for the sign. But again, there are definitely some nuanced things here, and this, I think any of the sign folks in the room will agree with me. This is very, very complex stuff. This is not a perfect bill in its current form. There's a lot of nuance to it and work that needs to be done in a work group. But that's the gist of where we would be going with the compensation element of it.
One final question of Ms. Joyce at this particular time, and I really need to get some definition here. We had folks come forward, and I think it may have been Mr. Smith that indicated that he'd gone out and had actually leased up six sites, got them all approved locally, got all of the work done locally. They're legal sites, legal locations, gets the necessary local permits, and under the 2006, under the March 2006 law, that should have been totally legal. Then he comes to you folks and says, could I pick up one of these state permits, which are being held in limbo right now? Your response, I take it, is no, you can't. You have to go to the other folks that actually have those. Will the state, if he had chosen to go ahead and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm pretty gutsy about this, I'm going to stick in the $50,000 to $75,000 to $90,000 per location to build that sign, is the state considering now giving the grandfather clause to those which have been legally constructed under the Supreme Court's decision?
Chair Beyer, Representative Butler, two things on that. I'll answer your second point first. I believe the way that the bill is drafted and the intent of it is, if signs are erected in this window period we've been talking about and they meet all the spacing and zoning and all these other requirements, that sign would be grandfathered in and granted a permit under the new system. Stepping backwards for a moment, I'm not sure if Mr. Smith was talking about coming to the state for permits before the Supreme Court decision, because certainly after the day after the Supreme Court decision, ODOT has not been requiring permits of anybody. So we are definitely complying with the Supreme Court's ruling. Nobody's required to get a permit from my office, and I make that abundantly clear to folks when they call. We do offer to review sites for folks to say, yes, you know, that site is going to meet all the regs. There's no charge for that. It's not a lot of red tape. We try to turn it around as fast as we can. Nobody's being required to get a permit since the day of that Supreme Court decision. But before that, if Mr. Smith came to me, I would have told him, you need one of these relocation credits to be able to, you know, yes, it meets all the spacing, the zoning, all this stuff, but unless you have one of those credits, I cannot write you that permit.
Okay, I have other questions that I need to follow up with Ms. Joyce, and I can do that out of committee time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank
I appreciate
you.
Your indulgence.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank everybody. And as I said before, it's my intent to do a work group on this bill. Those that are interested in working on it, please contact Judith. At this point in time, unless he's actually changed his mind, Representative Reed is going to head that up and may need backup on it. We'll see. So thank everybody for coming today, and I'm going to adjourn the meeting.
Hey, for a nice, simple...